On March 22nd, the Future of Life Institute, a non-profit organization focused on reducing existential risks facing humanity, and in particular existential risks from artificial intelligence, published an open letter entitled Pause Giant AI Experiments. Its signatories included tech luminaries such as Elon Musk and Apple co-founder Steven Wozniak. Its opening sentences read, AI systems with human competitive intelligence can pose profound risks to society and humanity, as shown by extensive research and acknowledged by top AI labs. Advanced AI could represent a profound change in the history of life on Earth and should be planned for and managed with commensurate care and resources. But given the kind of AI available today, are these kinds of concerns justified? Is ChatGPT, for example, really a kind of intelligence? And if so, are governments capable of taming it and channeling its capabilities for the benefit of humanity rather than its destruction? Welcome to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, I welcome to the podcast John Norton. He's a senior research fellow at the Center for Research in the Arts, Social Sciences and Humanities at the University of Cambridge, and the emeritus professor for the public understanding of technology at the Open University. He is also the technology columnist at The Observer. As you'll hear, John Norton offers quite a skeptical take on whether ChatGPT and its like are really worth of the name artificial intelligence, but is at the same time concerned about its potential effects in the unchecked hands of corporations. John Norton, welcome to The Philosopher in the News.
Thank you.
I'd like to start our conversation by, for those who haven't yet played around with ChatGPT, if you can describe some of the things that this new program is capable of, and then give us also the sort of abstract description of how it's capable of doing those things. What is it doing, really, in the background, as it were?
If you want a succinct description of what I think, it's a very good method for revealing the naivety of human beings, basically. I mean, what the thing that has astonished me about it from the beginning is the reactions of people who've tried it, because they're absolutely astonished that this thing can do anything, mm-hmm. and that it can do something partly that they find difficult quite well. But in the process, I think this is an old story. This goes back to the 1960s and Joe Wiesenbaum's famous ELISA program, which was just a script of a Rogerian therapist, and it was entirely deterministic, and yet, to his astonishment, Wiesenbaum found that people wanted to have intimate conversations with this ludicrous bot. Mm-hmm. And when ChatGPT arrived, well, people said, well, it won't be like that because it's much more sophisticated than ELISA. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, we see exactly the same reactions. ELISA was entirely deterministic. It was a script written by Joe. And ChatGPT 3 is not deterministic, it's probabilistic. And all it's doing is it's trying to predict what is most likely to be the next word in a given chain. That's it. It doesn't know anything, but it has ingested a huge corpus of what human beings have written on the web and elsewhere. But that's it.
So that's the abstract description of what it's doing. It's sort of predicting the next token in a series. So it can be a word, sometimes it can be a number. As you've mentioned in one of your columns, ChatGPT is also capable of programming. So it can write programming language if you ask it to write a program for a website or a game. It's able to do that as well.
It's able to do it in the sense that somewhere in its corpus there is an example of how it's done, mm-hmm. and it simply has been able to pull it up. In some cases, it for some trivial cases, if you're a non-programmer and you want to do, as many of us do want to do, find a way of using Python to automate some tedious tasks that you have to do on your computer, well, then the chances are that the code to do that has already existed and is just found. So, but then when ChatGPT spits it out, people say, wow, isn't it clever? If, on the other hand, you want to do something really kind of difficult, it will have a shot at it. But for example, friends of mine who work in the computer security business, they have a set of tests, tasks that they give to people applying for jobs in their line of business. So you have to write 5 or 6 pieces of code for a particular well-known things that need to be tackled in the security business, and ChatGPT will indeed write the code. But in some cases, anyway, it's full of the glaring holes that incompetent programmers make. You know, so
yes, and people have pointed out that it also outperforms the average human on things like the SAT or the GRE test, the LSAT, I don't know, all these kind of like graduate program tests for American universities that university graduates need to pass in order to be admitted into graduate programs. So it can do various things like that, right? So it can do, can write programs, it can summarize things.
Yeah, it's quite good at summarizing. But summarizing is not...
the ability. How does that work? Can we talk about summarizing? Because, I mean... It's not finding a summary of the text that you've given it on the kind of data that it's been trained on, and then produce that as a result of that data. So how does the summarizing work technically?
I honestly don't know. I think it's a useful capability. The point I was trying to make from the very beginning was in December last year, the editor of The Observer asked me and some of his other writers what 2023 would be like. And my reply was, it would be like 1993. And this caused a certain amount of puzzlement, because most people don't know the history. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, the internet that we use today, the one based on the TCP/IP family of protocols, was in development from the fall of 1972 and was switched on finally for the non kind of development world on January 1st, 1983. Okay, and for the first 10 years, the internet that we know today was up and running, and many of us were enjoying it, and some of us were encouraged to have utopian fantasies about how good it would be for society and so on. But the rest of the world paid no attention, right? And I used to get questions from people saying, what is this internet thingy that you're all excited about? What is it exactly? And what's it for? And what? And in vain would I try and explain to them where it was heading. And then in the spring of 1993, Marc Andreessen and Eric Biener, who had written the first graphical browser for this web, the web was invented by Tim Berners-Lee in 1989, released in 1991 on the internet server in CERN, and still nothing happened until that day when Mark and Eric released Mosaic, the first browser. And then the world discovered what the internet thingy was for, right? Now spool forward a bit, and for the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the tech world has been really obsessed with machine learning, but machine learning is a very kind of sordid kind of expression, and so the industry and its academic collaborators and admirers decided that they'd do a spot of rebranding, and they rebranded it as, quote, AI. Because AI is about artificial intelligence, and that sounds like a worthy kind of thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of... Whereas machine learning is a kind of grubby technology, flaky at its core as well. So there's all this talk about, quotes, AI. And the rest of the world looked on wonderingly. And then just as I had said to the editor, my editor, eventually in 2023, just the end of 2022, something called ChatGPT arrives. And suddenly the whole world wakes up and says, Jesus, that's what this AI is for. Right. And for the time being, we're living in the madness that that astonishing discovery has wrought.
Can we focus on the sort of reactions that people have had to that? One is the sort of, well, maybe there are three kinds of reaction. One is the sort of like maybe naive reaction of, wow, this is very cool technology. I can't believe that it's doing this. It seems really interesting. Then there are the kind of, you know, people in the know, as it were, who kind of understand how it works and sort of analyze it. And a little bit like you kind of dismiss it, right? There's been ChatGPT is dismissed as a kind of stochastic parrot, so-called. People say, well, it's just doing mere pattern recognition. It doesn't really understand anything. And this is often accompanied by, you know, showing kind of very embarrassing examples of ChatGPT's kind of nonsensical answers, just clearly showing that it doesn't understand really what it's being asked. And on the other hand, we have the sort of people who were signatories to this kind of recent letter asking for a pause to all AI kind of research. People like Elon Musk, you know, no Luddite himself, was part of one of the signatories, who seem to think that this is quite potentially quite dangerous. It can be hugely disruptive to human society. At the very end of that, worry are sort of apocalyptic like scenarios. And I just want to talk a little bit about those different reactions and how you make sense of them. So should we start with sort of what you started out as sort of saying, well, this is just, you know, humans being naive and kind of being impressed by a cheap party trick. Do you think there's a sort of danger of being overly dismissive of this technology because we maybe feel a bit threatened by it, or maybe this reaction comes from a place of insecurity to some extent, especially by people who work in, say, the, you know, journalism and other kind of creative professions that might feel like, oh, is this going to cause trouble for me down the line?
That's complicated and interesting. It's complicated because it's attributing single kind of explanations to aspects of the human reaction to it. Okay, so all this insecurity about one's job, so to speak, is a particular example. And if you take the long view of this stuff, this is exactly the kind of moral panic that we've seen from the introduction of any new communication technology. Okay, which is, and what it's an indicator of is that in those circumstances, and there's good historical evidence for this, is that from the very beginning of this, and possibly even if you went back to Gutenberg, but I'm not going to go there, we have tended to overestimate the short-term impact of these things and grossly underestimate their long-term impact, right? Mm-hmm. And at the moment, as you and I talk, we're in the early stages of the initial hysterical reaction.
So this is the grossly overestimating period.
Yeah, well, and also, but also focusing only on things that people can imagine. You can go back to Gutenberg if you want, but for example, if we take a technology that we now have and know a good deal about to our cost, i.e. the technology of recommender engine driven social media. Okay. We have evidence of its problematic impact on democracies, say. Okay, that took a while to develop, but you could have foreseen it. What I think nobody really foresaw until the other day was that this technology makes banking increasingly unstable. Because we saw in one day, $42 billion being extracted from a bank which had been suddenly being discussed on social media, and indeed had been discussed by the ratings agencies and so on. That happened because of a couple of tweets. And it happened in a day.
And also enabled, I guess, by online banking, right? Because you could have a run on the bank.
The point is that it was the two things.
Without people going to the bank.
The first was the way in which the panic could be spread, the speed with which it could be spread. And secondly, the ability to withdraw your money using a smartphone. Okay, now, the people who fretted about social media in the 2016 election of Trump, well, that election was, in that sense, that intervention in the election was kind of an easily foreseeable impact of social media.
Mm-hmm.
But the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank was something much deeper. In other words, what happened is that the technology has initial impact that people can understand because it affects things they know about and have thought about before and perhaps worry about. But the bigger and more profound effect is the longer term one, which is that the way in which a new technology or a particular kind of technology changes the whole landscape. That's the thing. And at the moment, I think the driving animating spirit behind that open letter of concern about and the stupendously naive idea that you could pause this stuff.
Mm. Yeah, we'll get to that.
We'll get to that. But the people who signed that letter are many of them, I think, quite smart. And some of them, I know that some of them signed it with some great deal of reservation. But the point is that it may be that what motivates them is the thought that the longer term implication of this might be really, really serious. I happen to think that the fears that they have in that respect are misguided because they're based on accepting the assumption assiduously fostered to some extent by the media that, and by some people in the machine learning community, which is that having stumbled onto this LLM, large language model system, that it, only if they just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and expanding this stuff, we'll get eventually to real superintelligence.
Right, right. So the idea is that, okay, ChatGPT at the moment still has all these limitations, but just using the same model and improving on it.
Yeah, ChatGPT-27 will be an existential threat for humanity.
Right. Yeah, which sounds weird if it's still a chatbot, right? That just sounds silly to say that a chatbot will end humanity or something.
If you want a way of thinking about this, there are two kinds of AI. Let's first of all accept for a moment that this is about artificial intelligence. This stuff is not about artificial intelligence, in my opinion. AI was just a convenient Orwellian kind of Orwellian type of branding for a rather grubby technology, which techies love. But let's accept it for a moment. There are two kinds of AI in that sense. There's AI as engineering, and there's AI as cognitive science. Everything we've got at the moment is AI as engineering, and the idea that you can, by simply having a GPT-27 and in the process heating the planet because of the computing required to make that happen, that somehow we'll get to the point where we suddenly have the real thing we need to worry about, which is superintelligence that might wipe us out. I just think that's mad.
Can I press you a bit on that? Because, I mean, so we have the sort of classic criterion by Alan Turing about sort of having created AI, which is essentially this idea that if you're having a conversation with a machine, but you can't tell that you're talking to a machine and you're tricked into thinking you're talking to a human, that's it. That's artificial intelligence. I mean, arguably, you know, depending on the prompts and how long you talk with something like ChatGPT, there are obvious ways in which, you know, it does reveal that it's not a human being. But can we not think that a chatbot can at least get very close or even pass the Turing test eventually? And will that not be some kind of intelligence? I mean, you know, I think I take your point completely, and I think this is something maybe we should talk about how, you know, cognitive science gives us insights into what is intelligence, what is understanding, all these things that seem to be completely lacking from something like ChatGPT. But at the same time, if we have this sort of like other, maybe more brute behavioristic kind of criterion of, well, what does this thing do and how does it interact with me? And can I tell the difference between that and a human? Isn't that worthy of the name intelligence?
Well, no, I would have said that what that shows is that the Turing test has outlived its usefulness.
Right.
Period.
Right.
Okay.
This takes us to this reminds me rather this sort of joke that says artificial intelligence is whatever computers can't do yet. So that we have all these criteria and computers keep reaching them and we're like, oh well, that's not interesting, that's too simple, this is not really intelligent, and we keep pushing the bar further and further afield. Does that reveal a different kind of a different kind of threat that we might feel, not in terms of our jobs, but sort of existential threat almost, that, well, sure, machines can do all these things better than us. They can play chess, you know, play Go, summarize, you know, a book in seconds, but, you know, they don't really understand or they don't really have imagination or whatever it is. We keep inventing these new criteria. What do you make of that?
A couple of things. The first is that the biggest lesson that I draw from this is that this current kind of slightly comical charade that we are living through, this obsessive cluelessness, it says more about human beings than it does about the technology. Mm-hmm. That's the first point. And also, it means that we are completely kind of hooked, like a fish on a harpoon, on one crackpot idea of what constitutes intelligence.
And what does it show about human nature? Just the fact that we're very vulnerable to hype, or does it reveal something deeper?
Well, no, we are vulnerable to hype, of course, but that's not the point. The point I was trying to get at is that we have been hooked for a long time on the idea of IQ, mm-hmm, as a sign of intelligence. And I've always thought that's nuts, because it's clear that if you want some kind of reliable indicator about this mysterious quality that we view as intelligence, it's a multi-dimensional property. Well, we only measure one thing, and that's what we say that's intelligent. For example, and we go back to the work of Howard Gardner all those years ago about the different kinds of intelligences there are. There's emotional intelligence, for example. There's spatial intelligence. And we could go on. So, for example, Howard Gardner showed many years ago that one of the things that was characteristic of great chess players in the days when non-machines played chess was that they had very high spatial intelligence. Why? Because chess is about the capture of space. And for years and years and years, Howard argued that this obsession with a single measure of IQ that you can measure with the test is absurd. And I still think it is absurd. And it's relevant to the current discussions we're having about whether or not a particular artifact is intelligent or not. It's perfectly possible, especially since ChatGPT is hooked up to Wolfram, that it will actually, in the end, be quite good at mathematics and display the kinds of IQ that we reward in the traditional intelligence test. And that's fine. It will have no emotional intelligence at all.
Sure. But does it have to be? Do the machines have to show exactly the same type of intelligence as humans do for us to recognize it as intelligence? Can't we broaden the category of intelligence, as it were, to include things that aren't exactly like human intelligence. I mean, presumably we would want to do the same if we came across, I don't know, alien life somewhere in the universe that has, for example, created a technological civilization, but maybe portrays no emotional intelligence or has no way of reading the intentions or feelings or whatever, or doesn't even have feelings. You know, won't we want to call that intelligence, even if it doesn't resemble our own?
We would have to find a term for it. But we might be mapping our particularly impoverished conceptions of intelligence onto it in order to make sense of it. I mean, one of the things that's very striking about the existential risk fears mm-hmm. about that one day we will have this superintelligent machine and God help us, right? Well, actually, as a species, at least in some parts of the world, we have a really good experience of living under or with superintelligences. They're called corporations.
Hmm.
Right? And we've had them for 200 years. And in the last 100 years, and particularly in the last 50 years, they have become the superintelligent machines which actually dominate our society. And we know what it's like to live under them.
So you think we can apply the term to corporations? We can say corporations are super intelligent.
I would say a corporation is a super intelligent machine. Yes.
Hmm.
Because it has capabilities much greater than humans. It has longevity much greater than humans. It has resources and power much greater than humans. Apart sometimes from...
Does it have emotional intelligence? Does a corporation
no.
have emotional intelligence?
Give me a break. I mean, I remember years and years ago when Google launched with this, in their IPO, they had this fatuous thing about how they don't be evil. Okay, well...
Which they later dropped.
Well, of course, the point, it was absurd from the very beginning, because our societies, democratic societies, since the war, have been building an environment in which we accept that these giant, super intelligent social machines have, first of all, they have certain kind of rights that they probably should not have in any democratic society, but more importantly, that we have allowed them to evolve in such a way that they only have one purpose, and that purpose is to maximize shareholder value. And it's the only purpose that big corporations have. The only one. They will might talk about stuff and the rest, but it's kind of infantilizing us for a corporation like Google to say, oh, well, our motto is don't be evil. The only motto they have is to maximize shareholder value, period. So do you see what I mean? That I can understand why people are worried about the prospect of superintelligent machines, which might not even want to keep us as pets. I can see that, you know, in some kind of fancy world way in the distance, just like nuclear fusion way in the distance. But the point is that we already have these things and we're unable to control them. You can see why there is a real existential fear about this, but we have plenty of experience of dealing with it now. For example, we know that that we're heading for a climate catastrophe. We know what should be done to stop it. But the problem is that we live in societies which are driven by these huge machines, and their only interest is in growth. And it's quite likely that they'll fry the planet before anybody. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of...
Yeah, this brings me to a couple of interesting questions, I think, which is, one is, we'll get to the sort of like, what should be done about all this? But one question is, what is this technology for, right? How are companies going to monetize this? What is the business model going to be? If we look at what the current business models of places like Google and Facebook and a lot of these companies are developing AI is essentially advertising. Do you see something like ChatGPT ending up sort of just becoming a sort of super super good advertising tool, or do you see it being monetized and used differently from these by these corporations?
Well, nothing complicated. There's no free lunch. So if you're going to maintain, and we're not talking at the moment at all about the environmental impact of this technology.
Yeah, I will come to that, because this is an interesting point you bring up in your columns about the processing power that has to go into these things and how much heat essentially they're releasing. And it's a similar problem with cryptocurrencies, I guess.
Yeah, except it may be that the kind of compute that's required for ChatGPT 27 makes Bitcoin look like a vicarious tea party. Okay, but nobody's talking about that at the moment. And it's disgracefully so in a way. But I suppose that one of the things I wanted to separate out from the line of questioning you were putting on is that my view about that, you said, what is the technology for? Okay, well, there are two views, at least two views about that, and we're laboring under the dominance of one. The first explanation of what it's for is that it is to make colossal amounts of money for those who can own and exploit it. And we have built a society since the Second World War, where the basic assumption is that those who own this kind of stuff get most of the rewards, and society has to kind of accept the dregs and move on. That's one view of it. Okay, my view about this technology is that what it is for and what it ought to be for is human flourishing. In other words, and this goes back a long way, but essentially I see it as it has the potential to augment human capabilities in all kinds of wonderful ways. We are tool making animals, and we have invented this very powerful tool, or these sets of very powerful tools. And instead of them being used for the purposes that they could be used, they are in fact being perverted to do certain kinds of things, in the process magnifying inequality and undermining democracies, among other things. Okay. So, and when this stuff came out, originally when I started seeing the early GPT stuff, the person who came to my mind was Douglas Engelbart. Wonderful, wonderful man working in the 1960s on what he called the augmentation project. And Douglas was the innovator of lots of the kind of technology we use today, including the mouse, for example. But he had this lab in Stanford Research Institute, the augmentation lab. And his view always was that the purpose of this technology is to enable human beings to do things they can't do any other way, in order to augment capabilities. And I'm really all in favor of that. And I see ChatGPT as an example of augmentation. Lots of people find it hard to write stuff, and they envy people who can. And goddamn it, here is suddenly there's a tool that helps me to do this stuff. A lot of people are excluded in society because they can't write the way you and I can write. Okay, well, here's a tool that might help them. The analogy that came to originally for me was the spreadsheet. Because in 1978, the Apple II was out, and somebody called Dan Bricklin wrote the first spreadsheet software ever, called a VisiCalc, and Apple, the Steve Jobs and Wozniak noticed that suddenly these computers they were selling, the Apple II, were selling not to, you know, guys in jeans and ponytails, but fellas in suits with ties. And what was happening was that these folks were going into these things called computer stores in parts of the US. They were seeing VisiCalc. And they had been taught at business school that if you do investment analysis, you have to do a spreadsheet. But you do it on a blackboard or a whiteboard. Okay, and they said, I want that. And the guy would say in the store, well, you have to buy the computer as well, and say, okay, I'll have that too, put that on expenses. Okay. Now, and that's, you can't imagine a world without spreadsheets now for everybody. And that's an example of augmentation.
You were saying that this technology should be for augmenting human capabilities. It should be this wonderful tool people can use it in all sorts of ways. Writing is one obvious example. And that's a very nice thought. And I'm sure that in many ways, ChatGPT will become something that people find invaluable, and in maybe a few years' time, people can't imagine, you know, working without it. It'd be like working without access to the internet or something. But then let's think about our current internet and the ways in which it has augmented, in many ways, our capabilities. We wouldn't be able to have this conversation, for example, if it weren't for the internet and if it weren't for these new platforms where we could just have a conversation no matter where we are. But also the ways in which these this technology, the internet, has in some ways took a sledgehammer at our capabilities, in particular destroyed our ability for long-term attention, has, you know, we're always constantly distracted, even if it isn't social media, it might just be email or someone texting us on our phone or us just flicking through the news on our just, you know, on our break or whatever. How do you think this will develop in the kind of long term? I know we said it's very hard to predict the kind of long term effects of this kind of technology, but if the current internet is the sort of, like, you know, 2.0 whatever internet has created the kind of social disruption that it has to people's attention, people's mental health, and in many ways, particularly young people. Well, I mean, should we then be quite worried about what is going to happen with something like ChatGPT? And can we really hope that, you know, the governments around the world are going to be able to regulate this in any way that prevents it from being a source of destruction and more a source of augmentation?
I think you need to be clearer about your terms.
Which ones?
You talk about this internet and its impact. You're not talking about the internet. The internet is a wonderful permissionless an architecture for permissionless innovation. That's what it is, and it was designed to be like that, and. It had from the very beginning all kinds of potential and possibilities, and it still has those potential and possibilities. But the problem we have is that it has been effectively colonized by a number of free riders on it,
mm-hmm.
And it is the activities and services and walled gardens that they have produced that is responsible for all of this. So to blame the internet for the ways in which the technology has been corralled and perverted for profit by large corporations is a bit like kind of blaming the telephone wires for some kind of bad behavior in teenagers in 1920s America. Give me a break. What you're talking about all the time, and what corporations have done with it. Nothing has changed with the internet. It works just fine. And if you're somebody like me, who still prefers the facilities that offers, whether it's open source software or particular kinds of encrypted communications or whatever, it's all fine.
But what most people use, the internet that most people use, isn't that internet. The internet most people use is Facebook, is Twitter, it's Google Mail. It's all these things that are now part of what we call surveillance capitalism. Well, it's not what the internet could have been, but it is what the internet is today. It's what we have. It's what we use. We could have prevented it, and maybe we still can. You know, there's still talk in America, about banning TikTok, about breaking up big tech and sort of, you know, destroying the kind of monopolies on our attention and time that these corporations have. But none of that has happened yet. So what makes us think that it might happen with something like this kind of large language programs and the kind of changes that they're going to usher in?
But all I'm asking for, Alex, is some linguistic hygiene.
How should we call the sort of surveillance capitalism internet?
It's a set of explorative business models which ride on the net. And which for much as I mean. If you want to look at the history of it, it's a bit like looking at Tim Wu's wonderful history of communication technologies in the US in the 20th century. And in each case, he observed the same cycle, which is the technology arrives, it's gloriously emancipatory, it encourages utopian hopes, and so on and so forth, and in the end it gets captured by industrial interests.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of that book, Tim's question was, will this happen to the internet? And the answer is, it has happened. But
can I ask, is this way of thinking about the internet, does it fall sort of prey to this idea of like technology as a sort of like neutral tool that can be used for good, it can be used for bad, it's all about how we decide how to use it? And you know, we've ended up in this situation, and it's being used for sort of less than virtuous purposes.
No, I think that, I mean, that's the way in which many people talk about this stuff, which is that, well, technology is neutral. This all depends on what uses it's put to, mm-hmm. and there is of course an element of truth in that. But technology itself is often not neutral either.
Yeah, I've heard you reference Heidegger in some of your earlier work a few times, and he's someone who very much thought that technology is not neutral. Technology has a sort of life or logic of its own and sort of is beyond the agency of those who use it. And arguably a phone, a smartphone arguably is very much a kind of proof of that, right? That, you know, we might have the best intentions, that it makes us do certain things that otherwise we wouldn't be doing.
No, I think that the conventional trope, which is that it all depends on the uses to which it's put, that's clearly like a trope is where the truth goes to die, and I can understand why that's a reasonable way to look at it, but it's also inconveniently for me. There's also an aspect of about technology, especially this kind of technology. Where the technology itself has implicit politics in it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Langdon Winner wrote that wonderful article many years ago about, do art effects have politics? Well, I often think of that in relation to this. So, for example, what drives the applications of the internet now, both in terms of social media and other things, is the inbuilt obsessions of engineers, because this is an engineering system, and engineers are interested basically in the end in only two things. One of them is efficiency and the other is optimization. And one of the reasons why the tech world has been so obsessed with machine learning is because machine learning is the ultimate optimization and efficiency system, right? And it's intrinsic in the technology. I used to be a control engineer once, and when I was doing control engineering, what we were trying to do always is we're trying to devise optimal ways of controlling feedback systems. And in order to have an optimal controller, then you have to have an idea of what it is you're trying to optimize. And you define that as an objective function, and then you spend all your time climbing a hill mathematically in order to get to the top. Okay. Right. Well, that's still what happens.
Mm-hmm.
Except now, in machine learning, we're climbing not one hill, but maybe 50 or 100,000 hills. simultaneously in order to find a maximum, and never knowing that we got a real maximum, we just know we've got a local one. So built into this technology is efficiency and optimization, right? And that's its internal politics, regardless of who owns it.
It's an inherent values in the technology.
Yes, okay. Now, sometimes that's wonderful, and sometimes efficiency is a pathologically damaging objective. If, for example, just one simple example, the criminal justice system that democracies have is arguably the most inefficient system in the history of the world. Why? Because the most efficient way of doing all of this is to lock up people on the say-so of the chief of police. But we don't do that. We have all this stuff about you're innocent till you prove guilty, about due process, about time and deliberation, and sometimes entrusting the big decisions to a randomly chosen group of our peers. Okay, that's very inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
The inefficiency of it is a feature, not a bug. It's what we think of as a requirement for a civilized society.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can't apply, as technocrats nowadays assume, that just because a particular public service is inefficient, and therefore it could be easily modernized and brought up to date. There are tech solutions for all of this stuff, including facial recognition and so on. That should somehow have the priority. And that's an inbuilt value which is suspect.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't this part of the worry of the sort of existential risk people? The idea that they do understand that efficiency is essentially the guiding value of this technology. And so this is what the famous thought experiment with the paperclip AI is, right? That you sort of program an AI and say, you know, make more paperclips, and then it turns
yes.
everything in our environment into a paperclip, because all it cares about is the sort of the goal and how to do it efficiently. So does that mean that in some ways, if this technology does have these kind of inherent inbuilt values in the way that it works, can we input our own values, or is that again a sort of naive thought that we can somehow humanize it?
It's both a naive and a civilized thought, and it has a name now, because in the discussions about AI, it's called alignment.
Right.
It's what Stuart Russell devoted the Reith lectures to. And what the kind of more thoughtful people involved in the AI racket are concerned about,
mm-hmm.
but again, our 200-year experience with superintelligent machines called organizations is useful experience in that, because we have signally failed to arrange alignment between the needs of democratic societies and indeed the needs of fairness and the and the quest for efficiency.
Yeah.
So it's the same, it's part of the same it's the same general problem. And aligning is not easy, we know that. We have made it deliberately very difficult for ourselves in modern democracies, especially liberal democracies, because the corporations have almost all of the advantages and none of the very few of the restrictions, even though they complain about them. And they have and they are prioritized in ways that that I think are not aligned with democratic values, and indeed with civilized values often.
Given that you mentioned democracy, is the problem only super intelligent corporations, or is the problem also certain governments? In your latest column, you mention the idea that there's a sort of arms race at the moment between China and the US, and and that's one of the reasons why you say this sort of like well-meaning letter by AI researchers calling for this kind of pause to on AI research to figure out what's going on and you know, maybe, you know, take a breath and kind of think things through a little bit, is not going to you know, have any effect, because the US is worried that China is on the same path as it is. And yeah. It's worried that it'll get there first and it will have all sorts of implications for security and so on. So is the problem also governments, not just superintelligence corporations?
Funnily enough, corporations are not the only superintelligent machine around. My friend and colleague David Runciman has a new book coming. And it's about the two kinds of machines that now govern our societies. And one of them is a state machine and the other is a corporate machine. And so the same kinds of thinking apply, I think, to the state as a machine as well. But I'm not a geophysics person, a geopolitics person, so and life is too short, so I leave that to experts. But I can see the same thing. The idea that the United States would easily cede what it sees of as a technological superiority to a rising rival is kind of unthinkable. It's as unthinkable as Google saying, well, actually, you know what? Maximizing shareholder value is not such a good idea. It doesn't happen. I mean, and one of the things that struck me about the open letter that causing for a pause, it's a bit like in the middle of the World Cup football final, suddenly some well-meaning streaker arrives on the pitch and says, hang on, I think we need to change the offside rule. This is ridiculous, right. You know.
Not going to happen. What do you think should happen? I mean, arguably, governments are still struggling to regulate, you know, places like Google and Facebook and TikTok is obviously a big item in the news, especially in the US, about whether, you know, it's sort of posing a security threat. What are governments going to be able to respond to? These technological advances, are they're you know, notoriously quite slow catching up with technology, understanding it. I remember this sort of like Senate hearing a few years back when, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was kind of trying to explain to them what exactly Facebook was doing with data and all the rest of it. And it was clear that most of them didn't have a clue what was going on. So is there any hope of one super intelligence governing the other, or are corporations going to win that war?
Well, the state machine has one thing that corporations don't have, which is it has a monopoly on coercion. So, I mean, there's one way of framing this, which I have done in the past, but it in some ways it's reductionist framing. But basically, my proposition was that liberal democracies can't control these outfits now. And the reason for that is that since the 1970s, with the end of the post-war Keynesian social democratic consensus and the arrival of what we now call neoliberal governance of various kinds, what has been happening is that liberal democratic governments across the world have been assiduously easing the rules under which corporations operate, and also in the process often eliminating the capacity of the state to do things that corporations do. But under democratic control, so that over a long period of time we have been eroding them, and we know that, for example, with the kinds of tech corporations we now have and their astonishing profitability, unrivaled in human history, that the old style kind of methods that were used in the past to control corporate power. First of all, may be very difficult to implement, and secondly, even when we do implement them, it doesn't work. For example, a few years ago, Facebook was fined $5 billion by the FTC for violating a consent decree. And on the day that fine was announced, Facebook shares went up. Okay, $5 billion is kind of pocket change. Okay, those kind of things don't work. What does work is changing the laws to make the leaders of corporations criminally liable. That really gets their attention. Mm-hmm. But it's almost unthinkable in current liberal democratic states to frame laws that way. Because of the power of lobbying, because of because of the inefficiencies in the system that are built in, partly the due process stuff, where it can take 10 years between the start of an antitrust suit and its resolution, or not at the end, and so on. So anyway, my conjecture was, I don't think liberal democracies can do it, but it can be done. Because, and that's perhaps one of the really useful things about Xi Jinping and the Chinese regime, they can do it.
Right.
And they do it really efficiently, and they're really good at it. Okay. And funnily enough, so my conjecture was, liberal democracies can't do it, only authoritarian states can do it. And then somebody pointed out to me, there is one other kind of body that can do it, which is not a democratic body. It is a technocratic body. It's called the European Commission. And they're the only game in town across the world in terms of regulation. It's either if the US manages to wake up and do something about it, or the EU does. But China and Russia do it fine. And so now, I hope I'm wrong about that, but it's too early to say. It's not looking good at the minute.
My final question is, what would you recommend to listeners of this episode for understanding either what artificial intelligence really is or should be, or understanding technology and technological changes and how to make sense of them whilst we're going through one?
I'd recommend a very straightforward book by an Irish economist. It's called The Nature of Technology. It's by Brian Arthur. And it tells you almost everything you need to know about how this stuff evolves.
John Norton, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
As always, this podcast was produced in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal, celebrating 100 years this year. To check out its latest issue and upcoming online events, visit thephilosopher1923.org. And if you enjoyed listening to this episode of The Philosopher in the News, don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. The link is in the show notes. I always appreciate hearing feedback from listeners, and it also helps others find the podcast. You can also share this podcast episode on social media and help spread the word. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again soon.